Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am very pleased to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Robert Perry, who is a journalist and an author, previously with the Associated Press and Newsweek. Bob Perry has broken many stories, including some related to the Iran-Contra affair and the October surprise. He is a recipient of the George Polk Award. He has been the editor of ConsortiumNews.com since 1995. Bob Perry's books include America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes, to Obama. Robert Perry, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
David, thanks for having me.
You had a great report this week about Syria and chemical weapons and the New York Times. Let's start back in August and September. What did the New York Times originally report that it has now had to admit is wrong?
Well, as I'm sure your listeners remember, on August 21st, there was a chemical weapons incident in the suburbs of Damascus in an area called Ghouta. The Obama administration pretty quickly pointed the finger at the Assad regime, the government in power in Syria, although the Assad regime denied responsibility. There were some allegations that perhaps Syrian rebels had carried out the atrocity, which killed several hundred people at least, with the idea of using it as a way to provoke the Americans to intervene in the civil war on the side of the rebels. This went back and forth a bit. The Obama administration on August 30th issued a curious document, which was called a government assessment. And it was a four-page white paper, in effect, and it accused the Assad regime of carrying out this attack, but offered no evidence at all. There was nothing presented that could be checked by any independent observer, journalist, or anyone else. So during that period, I was writing about sort of this very strange way the Obama administration had been carrying out what looked like a propaganda effort to whip the American people into another war fever to go against, in this case, the Syrian government. And one of the odd things about this government assessment is that no one had ever seen anything like it. Typically, when the U.S. is about to go to war or something like that, there's a national intelligence estimate, an NIE, and that's essentially a consensus view of the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. And if there are dissents from what the consensus is, they're also noted in terms of why some intelligence analysts disagree. That was avoided in this case, and they went instead with this strange thing called the government assessment. And the reason I was told was that there were a number of people in the U.S. intelligence community, a number of analysts, who did not agree that the evidence pointed to the Assad regime. They had much greater doubts. And in an NIE, that would have been exposed. So that was essentially being hidden. The mainstream press in general, however, went along with the Obama administration's case that the Syrian government had been the ones responsible. Although, again, there was no evidence that was being presented that could be checked. It was just assertions by the U.S. government in this case. When we get to September 17th, however, the New York Times does a front-page story which picks up on a set of allegations that Human Rights Watch had initially leveled, which had derived from a U.N. report on the attack. The U.N. report did not identify who the U.N. inspectors thought was responsible, but included some compass angles for two missiles, one that landed in an area called Mu'adamiya, and one was in an area called Zamalka. And Human Rights Watch had traced these azimuths back 9.5 kilometers, and they crossed at an elite Syrian military base. So this was kind of a big slam dunk moment, and the New York Times endorsed this and cited this as their own analysis as well. And this became the one piece of real evidence that was out there pointing to the Syrian government's supposed guilt. And that's what happened in mid-September. As we know, that the U.S. came very close to going to war. After the August 30th government assessment, the expectations were that probably that weekend, but within very few days, the United States would launch missile strikes to punish the Syrian government. We also know now that some of the rebels who have been working closely with the Saudi intelligence services and other Persian Gulf oil sheikdoms, had planned an offensive to coordinate with the American attacks with the idea that possibly they could overthrow the government and take power, or at least seize a lot of territory. So this would have been a very big deal if the United States had done this, perhaps bigger than President Obama had initially thought. He was thinking about just essentially a symbolic series of attacks, but this was clearly going to be something that would have brought the United States into this conflict in a military capacity, a direct military capacity, not just supplying weapons and other kinds of support, but having U.S. military forces engaged. It turned out that eventually, because the American public was pretty much against any such intervention, according to polls, and President Obama agreed then to take the issue to the Congress to get congressional approval for the attack. And in the interim, the Russians, who have been close allies with the Syrians, put forward this idea that the Syrians could simply give up all their chemical weapons, which they have, which they developed in a way to counter what they considered the Israeli nuclear threat next door. But they would give up all their chemical weapons, and that would be enough to placate the Americans. And President Obama agreed to that deal, and the Syrians went forward with it. Problem remains, though, that just 10 years after the American public was essentially goaded into an invasion of Iraq based on false information that the New York Times and other major publications presented to us, we were seeing something very similar happen again. And except for President Obama's last-minute decision to take the issue to Congress and then to accept this Russian idea, we might very well have engaged in another war against a country based on very flimsy information. And we now know that what also began to occur as we got through into the fall was that it became clearer and clearer that these two missiles that the New York Times said intersected at this military base 9.5 kilometers away from impact had no such range. Their range was being estimated at about 2 kilometers, maybe 3 kilometers, but certainly not 9.5 kilometers. One of those rockets, the one that landed in Mu'adamiya, also had no sarin in it. The UN inspectors found no sarin or no chemical weapons agents associated with that rocket at all. So there was only one, the one that landed in Zamalka to the east of Damascus, that had sarin. But you can't do a vectoring analysis if you only have one flight path. It became increasingly clear that there was no way that the Syrian government could have fired this rocket from 9.5 kilometers away, since the range was about 2 to 3 kilometers. It would have landed in the middle of Damascus if they had tried that. So the New York Times has been dragging its heels on this. A number of us have been reporting that this major piece of the case for war against Syria had collapsed for a variety of reasons, including the range of the missiles. But it wasn't until this past few days that the New York Times, in a story that they put way inside the newspaper, below the fold, and then in the 18th paragraph, they acknowledge that these missiles, based on new experts who have been consulted on this, that the missiles have no greater range than 3 kilometers. So essentially, the New York Times finally, in a very indirect, hidden way, retracted what had been a front-page story that had helped put us on the edge of war.
We're speaking with Robert Perry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com, and you can read his articles there at ConsortiumNews.com. It's depressing that human rights organizations are part of these sorts of promotions of new wars. It's come to be predictable with the New York Times. They push for a war, and then they apologize at the bottom of page 8 in the 18th paragraph. It seems to be a habit. I want to ask you, though, about the question that you brought up of the Russians' idea that the chemical weapons be done away with. Tell me if my memory is right, because as I recall, what happened was that John Kerry blurted out that all Assad would have to do would be to give up his chemical weapons. And when the Russians jumped on that, and Syria jumped on that, the State Department immediately said, no, 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 it was meant rhetorically to point out how absurd the idea would be that Assad would ever, ever do such a thing, you know, in effect, don't get in the way of our war. And in the meantime, meantime, the Senate and the House were making quite clear that they were going to vote no. They had demanded a vote, and now they were going to vote no. And Russia and Syria and the world were moving ahead, and by about a day later, John Kerry had switched and was saying, oh, I really, really meant it. I take credit for this. I'm sure it's going to work. So was it Russia's idea, or was it John Kerry's speaking before thinking?
Well, the Russians had put it forward privately with Kerry, and that's how it sort of popped out. It was something they were pushing behind the scenes. And Kerry was asked about this possibility at a press conference and said, well, yes, that could work. And then, you know, then there was this effort to say, well, but of course the Syrians will never do it. The Syrians, of course, did do it. And eventually this became the route out of the crisis. But the Russians played a very significant role in this. They had been working behind the scenes with President Obama to try to convince him that this would have been a very bad idea. And it wasn't just a bad idea in the sense that it would have involved the United States in the Syrian civil war, where neither side is exactly wearing a white hat. But it would also probably have destroyed any possibility of having an agreement with the Iranians, who have also been backing the Syrian government. And that would have put their nuclear program in a much more serious situation in terms of a possible war there. So you could have seen by the United States moving ahead, as it was on the verge of doing at the end of August, and attacking, it could have both involved the U.S. much more deeply in the Syrian conflict, but also have created a region-wide conflagration. The Israelis have been very clear that they would like to see an attack to take out the Iranian nuclear facilities. And if the negotiations with Iran had been made unfruitful because of this expanded conflict with the United States with Syria, that could have easily set the stage for a much broader war. So the Russians were trying to convince, and ultimately did convince, President Obama to pull back and to try this other route. And John Kerry was very much the guy leading the charge. I know that surprised some of his supporters and some Democrats, but he was perhaps the most aggressive of the public officials out there, pushing for conflict with Syria. He was the one who gave this remarkable speech on August 30th at the State Department, which sounded like, to most of us, like a declaration of war, something you would have expected the President of the United States to do, not the Secretary of State. But Obama, I was told, was always very reluctant to go to war, to use force. He was considering some kind of pinprick, as the phrasing goes here, a very limited military assault, but he was also being pushed. If he'd done that, he would have been pushed further. There would have been efforts to say, well, that's not enough, we have to do more. And he would have been very much on a slippery slope into a much deeper involvement. So he did have at least the brains to find a way, with the help of the Russians, around that problem.
I think the combination of thinking there ended up coming out of John Kerry's mouth in the form of contradictory predictions that this would be a major development that would turn the tide and it would have absolutely no impact, which made him rather less than credible, I thought. But I can recall Senator John McCain quite a while back now, prior to this particular crisis, openly pushing in an interview for a war, a U.S. War in Syria, as a step to get to a war with Iran, an overthrow of Assad because of his relationship to Iran, and as a step toward the necessary overthrow of the Iranian government. How much was that motivation, do you think, part of what was going on in Washington?
Well, as you know, David, the neoconservatives have never given up their dream, this rather, or many of us would consider kind of a nightmarish dream, but one that they concocted in the middle of the 1990s, when they decided that there was really no reason to negotiate with Arab or Muslim states, that Israel should move toward a policy of regime change to eliminate these so-called hostile states. There was this plan that Richard Perle and Douglas Feith and others prepared for the 1996 campaign of Benjamin Netanyahu, who was seeking the prime ministership at that point. And that evolved in the next couple of years into the Project for the New American Century, urging President Clinton to attack and overthrow the Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein. Clinton did not do that, but after George W. Bush took office and after the 9/11 attacks, the way was opened for the neocons to pursue this regime change concept. And it wasn't just Iraq they were aiming at. They were aiming at first Iraq, but then they wanted to go to Damascus and take out the Syrian government of the Assad regime. And they wanted to go to Iran, to Tehran, and take out the government there and put in essentially governments that would accept Israel's position and be essentially puppets of the United States. The thinking was then that once all those states were in line with the U.S. and Israeli policy, that the closer in enemies of Israel, Hamas and Hezbollah, would be cut off from support and would have no choice but to more or less accept the peace terms as dictated by the Israelis. So that was sort of the grand scheme of things. And they, and remarkably, the neocons were able to carry out the first phase of it, which was an unprovoked invasion of Iraq, which got rid of the Hussein regime, but ended up being a monstrous, bloody failure in many other ways, leading ultimately to the election of President Obama, who was less enthusiastic in these areas, the idea was still that he could be manipulated into taking various positions that the neocons wanted. President Obama, when he took office, left in much of President Bush's hierarchy. You still had General Petraeus, you still had Secretary Gates at Defense, and he put in a sort of a neocon light Hillary Clinton over at State. So there was still a lot of momentum within his administration to continue war policies. He was able over time to shift that somewhat, but the neocons have remained a very influential force in Washington. They still control the op-ed pages of the Washington Post. They still control many of the major think tanks in Washington. So when they want to push something in a certain direction, and they also, of course, have many allies in Congress, like Senator McCain, when they want to push something in a certain way, they are often much more successful than you might think they'd be in getting the U.S. government to either go along, or either willingly or to acquiesce and go along, perhaps a bit unwillingly, but still to go along. And that was pretty much where they thought they had President Obama relating to Syria, using the incident on August 21st as the casus belli to get another war going and to get regime change in Damascus. So I think people like Senator McCain have not, like the other neocons, haven't really given up on this grander vision that they have of how to reorder the Middle East. They just don't have as willing a partner in President Obama as they had in President Bush.
It seems like when they were pushing this this new justification for missile strikes into Syria, and yet presenting no evidence, not even any phony evidence, but no evidence, it was clear to a lot of us, as I'm sure it was clear to you, and you were writing accordingly at the time, that at best, the Obama administration was guessing and hoping that Assad did this, and at worst, was lying. It seems like that was apparent to observers at the time. You've blogged relatively recently about Seymour Hersh's report, which he had to go abroad to publish, about what went on here. What did that add, and how has your understanding of this changed since September?
Well, Fyhirsch confirmed much of what I was being told at the time. We were writing this in August and September, that there was significant dissent within the U.S. intelligence community as to what happened. There wasn't this consensus that the Obama administration was pretending existed. And that does explain why they used the government assessment rather than an NIE to try to make the case, because they could then bury the fact that there was so much dissent. But what Cy Hirsch had was some of his sourcing, people that he's worked with or have known for a long time inside the intelligence community, who were telling him the same thing, that that there was this dissent, that there was a threat from some of these analysts that if the Obama administration had tried to go forward with an NIE that did not contain their dissent, that they would have gone public. And that's a very important development. That is something that we kind of knew, but Hirsch provided a good deal more detail to it. But he was unable to get it published in the United States. I understand that he went to the New Yorker magazine, where David Remnick was, of course, one of the liberals supporting the Iraq War, if you remember, David. And Remnick was not willing to publish this at the New Yorker. And then I'm told he went to the Washington Post as well, and they would not publish it. So he had to go to the London Review of Books. Cy Hirsch had to go to the London Review of Books, one of the most distinguished journalists of modern American history, to get this information into the public domain in a published format. So what it shows is that we still are facing this fairly dangerous circumstance where the mainstream press, along with many of the prominent think tankers in Washington and a lot of politicians, pundits, still are very eager to go to war on the flimsiest of circumstances. If this is some kind of designated enemy state, clearly Iraq when it was run by Saddam Hussein, was a designated enemy state of the U.S. And so anything that was said about it could, I guess, was supposed to be believed. And of course, the New York Times and others published stories that turned out to be completely false, like the piece in 2002, which alleged that some purchase of aluminum tubes was proof that Saddam Hussein was running a secret nuclear weapons program. Turned out that the tubes were not suited for that. They were actually being used for artillery. But that was an important part of the momentum that drove us toward war with Iraq. But we still seem to have the same team in place. That there was very little accountability. And I've written about this a lot. Coming out of the Iraq War, there should have been a lot of accountability. Not only should people like President Bush and Vice President Cheney and their upper echelons have been held accountable for war crimes, including aggressive war under false pretenses, but there should have been accountability within the press corps. I've lived through in my work in Washington since the 1970s. I've seen journalists severely punished when they basically had their stories correct, but maybe there was someone who alleged that there was some minor discrepancy or some little thing, and they've had their lives ruined. Gary Webb is a good example, a reporter who, the San Jose Mercury News, who in 1996 revived a story that I'd been involved in earlier, the Contra drug story, and it was alleged that he didn't get it precisely 100% right, so he was driven out of journalism and ultimately was driven to suicide. And so you see that kind of extreme accountability for a journalist who basically gets stories right. Yet, when all these important journalists in 2002 and 2003 got a major story, i.e. the Iraq War, completely wrong, there was almost no accountability at all. I mean, Judith Miller of the New York Times was sort of forced out, but she was an extreme case of being in league with the neocons in this. But there were many other reporters who were almost as guilty as her who are still there. Bill Keller, who had been part of the so-called liberal war hawks, were war hawks group that included David Remnick of the New Yorker and other supposed liberals. Bill Keller after being wrong about Iraq, was then promoted to be executive editor of the New York Times. In other words, he wasn't punished for being entirely wrong about the Iraq War. He got one of the biggest rewards possible in American journalism, perhaps the top job, the executive editorship of the New York Times. So you had this completely upside-down sense of accountability. And those of us who were highly skeptical and were highly skeptical in real time about Iraq and other issues have continued to be pushed to the sidelines, including someone like Cy Hirsch. So what you have is a media structure that is almost reversed what it should be. We punish people who get things right, who go against the grain and stand up to the government lies, and we reward the people that go with the flow and put out propaganda that misleads the American people into disasters like the Iraq War, which has cost the country perhaps well over $1 trillion, not to mention some 4,500 dead soldiers and estimates of hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqis, and the deaths in Iraq are continuing to this day, as you know. So that's the problem. The problem is we haven't addressed that.
It's absolutely shameful. We are unfortunately running out of time, about a minute left, and I wonder if you agree with me that perhaps the greatest accomplishment of this communication system is that they've got everybody asking the wrong question to begin with. That is to say, had all of the lies about weapons in Iraq been true, would it have been any legal, practical, or moral justification for launching a war on Iraq? And had chemical weapons been used by the Syrian government, would that have in any way legalized or made moral or practical or reasonable dropping missiles on Syria and killing yet more people? Aren't we necessarily and importantly answering the questions, but aren't they the wrong questions to begin with?
Well, it's a fair point, David. I mean, the Nuremberg principles that were established by the United States and the victorious powers of World War II made clear that aggressive war was the ultimate international crime because it unleashed all the other aspects of war crime. And there were procedures set up to deal with these kinds of issues when they occur, and it's not for one country to go off on its own and start attacking another. That's what the whole idea of the Nuremberg principles and the United Nations was designed to prevent. So your point's well taken, but on top of that, even the claims that sort of got the American people into kind of a war frenzy in Iraq, and there was the effort to get them in the same state over Syria, were based on lies. And that is I think that's an additionally important fact to consider.
On the upside, Consortium News is alive and kicking, and the American people did not get into a war frenzy over Syria. Quite the reverse. And so there is something positive happening in some people's minds. Perhaps they're reading Consortium News and not the New York Times. Robert Perry, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, Dave.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.